ghosts.
Hello, Ghostbusters.
They're real.
You do?
They're mean.
You have?
They're here.
We got one!
Mr. McGee, don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
I'm Dean Karyanis.
And I'm Owen Mugen.
Welcome to the Angry History Show, folks. We've lost some great people with a lot of history since we started this program. We always talked about increasing our rapid response here, enabling us to respond to the breaking news with an eye towards history. And the passing of legendary writer, producer, director Harold Ramis really made us want to make this the first time we made this foray into kind of breaking news.
Right, a little rapid response. It's funny, the first time I remember Harold Ramis on screen was in Stripes, and it was at this Third Run Theater on Avenue J in Brooklyn, and that year it was the 81-cent theater. It's funny, each year it just went up. I saw Meatballs there when it was the 79-cent theater, on and on and on. But it was funny. I remember thinking of him in this movie. I was like, who is this dude? He seemed like such a straight guy, you know, which he was. But, you know, he always talked about comedy being somewhat subversive. But there was absolutely something subversive lurking beneath this the straight-laced face of Harold Ramis. But let's get things going here with a bit from that movie, a little bit where he's teaching English.
Okay, that's really very good. I'd like to try it just one more time, and then we'll call it a day. I met her on a Monday, and my heart stood still.
Da-do-ra-ra-ra-da-do-ra-ra.
Somebody told me that her name was Jill.
Da-do-ra-ra-ra-da-do-ra-ra.
Okay, great, great. All right, I'll see you next week. We'll learn some new tunes. We'll have a great time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You know, you talked about it being a straight man and him recognizing that, and I think of Abbott and Costello, who of course are a touchstone for both of us. Channel 11, Rush Home After Church, watch, gotta get some Abbott
or the cartoon, I've been a bad boy. That was a terrible, remember that cartoon?
Calling car 00, car 00.
That's us, Abbott, go 0.
Think for yourself, Costello.
Investigate report of strange creature, 100 feet high, dripping wet, and talks like this.
Originally, Costello was the famous guy, and Abbott was a little nobody. You know, one guy from Paterson, New Jersey, Abbott from down in Asbury Park. And he came on and he said, I'm talking with you, Mr. Costello. I'd love to work with you. I'm so glad you called me. He's like, well, call it Costello and Abbott. And he said, no, bullshit. Oh, gosh, I'm not supposed to say that. But anyway.
Look at you!
Well, that was the actual quote. I remember reading as a kid. Talk about subversive, reading it in his book as a kid. He said, no, the straight man always comes first. And he said, all right, well, we'll split it then down the middle, you know, or give you more. And he said, no, sure. Abbott, comedians are a dime a dozen, but a good straight man is really hard to find.
Really?
And Costello insisted on giving him 60%, and he took 40%. And they had that through all the movies they made through their entire career together.
That is insane. Because
that makes me
really
think of
nuts.
Harold Ramis, you know, that kind of guy, just a straight man, and seeing that role, and he saw it when he worked with guys like John Belushi. He said, I'm never going to be the guy throwing myself off the stage.
Right.
But, you know, he was just able to sort of grow into that and give the funny line every now and then. And he said that kept me on stage.
Oh, he was really terrific.
He was also at the end of the bar in Chicago when I first met my wife face to face in 1999. That was really exciting for me. I mean, it was nice to meet her, but, you know, it was, but she happened to be a former musical director of Second City, and we were there for the 40th anniversary. Everybody's watching out for different people, and I gotta say, he was the guy I was most impressed to see, just because, I guess in a way, how unimpressive he was, just because he's there, opposite end of the bar from me, hanging out. Everyone's waiting for Bill Murray, which is great, and
sure,
you know, these really big guys. But here's this just quiet, creative writer guy. Doesn't care if anybody notices him, and you got the feeling he might have been there even if it wasn't the big 40th anniversary bash. He liked to be around people. He was a regular guy, a mentor to so many people. You can read all these stories that are out there. But I felt like it was nice to have a little connection with the guy, because I think, like his daughter said, you know, he was like a campfire. Everybody wanted to be around him. He was just that kind of warming personality.
What's interesting too, you know, you so often we think of the stereotype of the stand-up or the comedy guy, and there's like so much damaged goods and all that, and he didn't seem to be any of these things. You know, he seemed to be like what you said, and I never spoke to the man. We did share a giant picnic table once out in Martha's Vineyard at this place called Homeport, which is a sort of an outdoor restaurant where you just fill your face with beer and seafood. And he was there with his family once a few years ago, and he just seemed like he couldn't have been, you know, nicer guy. And I guess just for those reasons, you know, having seen him and seen him interact with his family, where he seemed to be just such a kind of a mensch. And then this very surprising news on Monday the 24th that he had died, it really seemed to strike a lot of us, you know?
Yeah, and he kept it quiet, too, which I think is also something we don't hear about so much. I mean, he did a lot of charity for the Children's Tumor Foundation, I believe it was. He did a lot of things for other people, and yet it's sort of a throwback to an age where if you did have a problem, you just didn't want to bother people, and only close family and friends knew about it. And it was nice to see, because he was a loyal guy. For instance, he'd committed to writing for Second City when Saturday Night Live offered him a job, and he rejected it because he'd made a commitment. And it was nice to see people that were loyal to him, and friends did come and visit him. He patched over the estrangement he'd had with Bill Murray for a while, and many years, actually. And so
20 years. I mean, what, 93 was Groundhog Day.
Yeah, too bad. But, you know, if you were a time traveler, I think, visiting the 80s, and you needed to bank some cultural references, this would be the guy whose body of work you'd go to, don't you think?
Well, without a doubt. I mean, Ghostbusters, Vacation, Stripes, Caddyshack, Meatballs, Animal House, Back to School. I love that movie so much. Oh, just a quick little side divergence here on a show that we're trying to keep short. Back to School, Keith Gordon. I know you know this, Dean. Keith Gordon, who played Rodney's son in that, went on to be a really very good director. And he directed a great World War II movie, Battle of the Bulge movie, called Midnight Clear. And so go look for that, guys. And then when you're watching it, and I defy you to not be moved by it, and remember that it's Rodney's kid from Back to School who directed it. But and let's see, in the 90s, Groundhog Day. Yeah, I analyzed this and kept just cranking out the laughs until fairly recently. He directed some episodes of The Office. And just to show you how deeply it's in the nation's comedy DNA, we have a standard episode of the show that we're editing, and we mentioned the Baby Ruth and the pool gag from Caddyshack. You know, it's just, he really kind of is this presence that if you peel things back, there's Harold Ramis.
Yeah, he's really everywhere. I mean, this is why I think we had a lot to say, because sometimes the guys who are reluctant before the camera, you don't really mark it when they go, you know, and he was that sort of guy. 69, not an old man, and he died of this autoimmune vasculitis disease where his body's own defenses started attacking his blood vessels as if they were foreign invaders. You know, painful, debilitating. He had to relearn to walk just a couple years ago in 2011. Tough way to go.
It is tough. And again, with someone who just, you know, so many of us just seem to like, you know, and respect for his tremendous comedy chops. In one of his last interviews, he talked about the prospects for Ghostbusters 3, which always seems to have come up. And they did some stuff. I think, didn't they lend their voice to one of the later Ghostbusters video games and all that? But the third movie just never showed itself. And he was saying in this, in terms of freshness, for example, Spider-Man 3 wasn't as good as the first one. And bless him, how Crystal Skull was a disaster. You know? And he said, quote, "We could reap the reward and make a lot of money, but no one wants to do that. And if the public only has two Ghostbusters, that would be okay. That would be fine." And I just, I'm watching that interview, and it's such a big smile on his face. I don't know. I'm hung up on just, it's seeming like, you know, we just lost a real nice guy, you know?
Yeah, he was a nice guy. Everybody universally, I mean, we have a bunch of quotes here, and we could probably fill an hour-long show just with quotes on what a nice guy was. Nobody had anything bad to say about him. And you can see when you even look at somebody and how people act around them, if they're walking on eggshells or what. And this was a smart kid, too, and he grew into a smart man. National Merit Scholar, earned a scholarship to Washington University in St. Louis, and he used many of those experiences there for writing Animal House, which I found like kind of a cool little thing there. You wonder how much of it was his real life.
Oh, it's amazing.
The scene where the boys are hitting golf balls at the RTC building, that was something that he actually did. And he followed one of the rules of Second City, which is to always work at the top of your intelligence. And I think that's such a great rule, because it's something that we don't necessarily see much anymore.
No.
By the way, he also spoke Greek to the owners of the local coffee shop that he had there in Chicago. So more points in my book.
Absolutely. Yeah,
coffee for him. For
absolutely
that.
Right. And it's funny, there's some history in Stripes, too, for example. Ramis and Bill Murray's characters, they go through basic at Fort Arnold, okay, and that's the name that we now know as West Point. And there was a fort named for General Benedict Arnold, whose name was stripped off the fort and everything else after his egregious betrayal. He was a bookworm. Here's an impromptu PSA for his local library in Highland Park outside Chicago, and it sets up a bunch of things we want to talk about. Let's give a listen.
Okay, so why do you love libraries?
Because they have books in them. And we're, you know, books are disappearing. Young people don't read, and it's a tragedy because a book is the most direct experience because you're in control of how you process it. You can take your time, you can reread, you can get lost in thought, you can come back to it. It's not passive, it's active, and keeps the mind alive.
Ramis lived in L.A. in the late 70s when he decided to pick up his family and move his production company in downtown Highland Park outside Chicago. He said he was happy to leave the, quote, the artificial pressure of L.A. Quote, I've compared it to high school. Am I popular? Am I cool? Am I in? Who's the in crowd? How do I get into that party? These are not things I ever wanted to worry about. Here I am so liberated from that, end quote. That's good for you, man.
Yeah, you can relate, I think, a little bit.
Sure, sure.
You get caught up in a rat race anywhere you are, and to have the, I don't know, it's a certain kind of person that sort of wants to come home where they were from, and I'm glad that he had a home to go to.
Absolutely.
You know, where he felt so comfortable.
And he was able to live, you know, with I guess the last 18 years of his life there. I think he moved back in 96 or so.
Yeah, I saw how he wanted to try to get De Niro and Billy Crystal to come there to shoot, analyze this, and they wouldn't do it. You know, like yeah. he was a homer, you know, and a regular guy. And it's nice that that's still a city where you can be that way.
Yeah.
Because I think he wanted to blend in, you know. First and foremost, the guy was a writer, and he had to be coaxed in front of the camera. And this is something we learned looking into him a little more.
Sure.
For instance, we talked about the moment that he knew that he wasn't going to be a John Belushi or a Bill Murray.
Right.
He told the Chicago Tribune in 1999, this is right around the time of that 40th anniversary of Second City, the moment I knew I wouldn't be any huge comedy star was when I got on stage with John Belushi for the first time. When I saw how far he was willing to go to get a laugh or to make a point on stage, the language he would use, how physical he was, throwing himself literally off the stage, taking big falls, strangling other actors.
Speaking of Miss Belushi, too.
I thought, I'm never going to be this big. How could I ever get enough attention on stage with guys like this? I stopped being zany. I let John be zany. I learned that my thing was lobbing in great lines here and there, which would score big and keep me on the stage.
There you go. That's really something else.
He found a spot, you know, and there's a bunch of these. We can rattle them off. I mean, he wanted the Boone role in Animal House. John Landis thought he was too old.
Yeah.
So he wasn't in that. He didn't take the bit part they offered him. He didn't want to be the character in Stripes. They auditioned Dennis Quaid, and it was Bill Murray who insisted on it because mm-hmm. he wanted this kind of guy out there. I mean, Animal House and Stripes, like these guys were ad-libbing a lot. Ghostbusters, too. You know, they were ad-libbing, and he wanted a guy with Ramis's chops out there with him.
Well, and you know, it's funny, think about Ghostbusters. I was 14 when I came out, and you know, we watched the hell out of that in the movies. And to me, you know, it's one of these, in movies often you have someone who represents the audience position in one way or another. And that was him, in a sense, you know, because he was the straight guy, but there was that subversive streak that ran through him in that movie. But, you know, he was our straight guy in that film, and man, I love him for it.
One example of the kind of ad-libbing he brought to it, and if you get a chance to watch it again, watch this scene sort of there in the beginning when Venkman, Bill Murray's character, says to him,
I know you're going here.
He's talking to him, and he talks to him about the time he tried to drill a hole in his own skull. And Harold Ramis, as Spangler, just ad-libs, that would have worked if you hadn't stopped me. And looking back at it now, like he delivers it absolutely perfectly.
Yeah.
You would not have thought that, okay, this is just a line that he riffs off. There's like a little bit of that sort of, you know, I don't want to say a nerdy guy, it's obviously a nerdy character, but
sure.
Somebody who's really intense about something and you stop them from doing it.
Yeah.
You know, that was like, I mean, absolutely perfect. And we lost a lot of those moments now, I guess, that we won't see, but he gave us so very many.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Harold Ramis once said, we represent the underdog as comedy usually speaks for the lower classes. We attack the winners.
Yes.
And I found this fascinating reading it today. You were kind of talking about it right there, something subversive about a Meatballs or a Caddyshack.
Right.
Because when somebody dies, you know they're great when everybody immediately kind of wants to claim them. And I looked around and I saw a lot of that. One called Ghostbusters, the greatest libertarian movie of all time, because they faced down an EPA bureaucrat. And the New York Times, I mean, the piece, some people were even commenting some of the stuff that they wrote. That's where I saw that thing about the Greek diner.
Right.
Was just a little funny. Douglas Martin, he wrote in his obit, Quote, Vincent Canby, writing in the New York Times, praised Mr. Ramis's direction, saying the movie, he's talking about Caddyshack here, quote, tears the lid off the apparently placid life at a waspy country club to expose bigotry, ignorance, lust, and a common tendency to cheat on the golf course. I was like, wow, I'm not sure of many things, but it seems like, you know, of this nature where it's not my mind, but I don't think that that's what he and Ted Knight and those guys, you know, they're making some expose of golf course. I mean,
right.
I don't know what this guy must have thought of duck soup. I mean, that was really subversive against the... It's just kind of funny, like, and he got something wrong in there too that I wanted to mention about it. He said a clergyman is struck by lightning as he thanks God for the best golf game of his life.
Oh, that's right.
But he doesn't. He curses God because he misses that last hole when he's out there.
Right.
And how many times have we said, again, so many of these lines, how many times have you said, I don't think the heavy stuff's going to come down for some time now?
Yeah.
You know, I think over the next weeks, we're going to really notice those lines.
Absolutely. More. And of course, I mean, there is a lot of great manners play in Caddyshack, you know, and Ted Knight is, you know, he is at his Ted Knightness. Ted Knightiest, perhaps, in this movie as this guy. You know, the world needs ditch diggers too, Denny. You know, and it was definitely a manners comedy and a class comedy in that way. What was the line that Rodney says to his wife? Hey, you want to make 12 bucks the hard way? Yeah. Oh gosh!
And it's also worth noting. I mean, he was that was a running gag for Ted Knight was that he was always being mistaken for Barry Goldwater in the run. Like, I guess he'd supported Goldwater too, and they were all there, I think, to have a really good time. And it's just funny to, you know, when you create something so great and then people look at it and say, oh my God, I see so much in it, you know, and there is a lot in it. And that's why that's great art, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely right.
We want to make another remark about Ghostbusters. Last year, when we were both in Tribeca together, Owen and I, we decided to shoot a quick video for a video podcast at the Hook and Ladder No. 8 Firehouse across from Walker's Restaurant. Some of you may have seen it at facebook.com/angryhistory, but here's a little bit of us just talking about this kind of thing you can only find when you know where to look.
You see this firehouse? Look familiar?
Should if you grew up in the 80s.
Right. If you care about pop culture at all. All right, this should help.
Yes, that's right. Who are you going to call? This was the exterior set for the Ghostbusters headquarters in the first film.
An actual working firehouse,
and one of the firemen who died in the line of duty, keeping us safe in the city. And I'm gonna see if you can see inside. It's tough to. Oh yeah, here it is. You can kind of see it. These are old telephone handsets that were recovered from fire. It's sort of a little trophy. But anyway, these guys keep us safe. And of course, you can't go to many firehouses around here and not see a plaque commemorating people who were lost in the attacks of 9/11.
And we actually were, truly, we were coming from Walker's Restaurant. So it was an awesome idea at the time because we'd been in Walker's for quite a while. And we did it on our phones. And I do love that firehouse. It really is an institution. And when Mayor Bloomberg tried to shut it down, 100 people showed up to protest, including then public advocate and current Mayor Bill de Blasio and actor Steve Buscemi. And he was a former fireman himself. Yesterday, when word hit that Ramis had died, an impromptu memorial sprung up outside No. 8. People left Twinkies, a little reference to this scene from Ghostbusters with Ernie Hudson.
I'm worried, Ray. It's getting crowded in there, and all my recent data points to something big on the horizon.
What do you mean, the big?
Well, let's say this Twinkie represents the normal amount of psychokinetic energy in the New York area. According to this morning's sample, it would be a Twinkie 35 feet long, weighing approximately 600 pounds.
That's a big Twinkie.
Bill Murray, who worked with Ramis on a half dozen projects in the 80s and 90s, issued this statement to Time through his lawyer in the wake of Ramis' death on Monday morning. Quote, Harold Ramis and I together did the National Lampoon show off Broadway, Meatballs, Stripes, Caddyshack, Ghostbusters, and Groundhog Day. He earned his keep on this planet. God bless him. End quote. Here's a clip from Caddyshack.
So I jump ship in Hong Kong, and I make my way over to Tibet. And I get on as a looper at a course over there in Himalayas.
A looper?
A looper. You know, a caddy, a looper. Jack. So I tell him I'm a pro Jack. And who do you think they give me? The Dalai Lama himself. The 12th son of the Lama. The flowing robes, the grace, bald. Striking. So I'm on a first tee with him. I give him the driver. He hauls off and whacks one. Big hitter. Dilemma. Long. Into a 10,000-foot crevice right at the base of this glacier. Do you know what the lama says?
No.
Gunga Galunga. Gunga, Gunga La Gunga. So we finish 18, and he's going to stiff me. And I say, hey, lama, hey, how about a little something, you know, for the effort, you know? And he says, oh, there won't be any money. But when you die, on your deathbed, you will receive total consciousness. So I got that going for me, which is nice.
That is one of the the classic, highly quotable bits. And in President Obama's statement about the death of Harold Ramis, he manages to get that in there as well. Quote, Michelle and I were saddened to hear of the passing of Harold Ramis, one of America's greatest satirists and, like so many other comedic geniuses, a proud product of Chicago's Second City. When we watched his movies from Animal House and Caddyshack to Ghostbusters and Groundhog Day, we didn't just laugh until it hurt. We questioned authority. Huh. We identified with the outsider. We rooted for the underdog. And through it all, we never lost our faith in happy endings. Our thoughts and prayers are with Harold's wife, Erica, his children and grandchildren, and all those who loved him, who quote his work with abandon, and we hope that he received total consciousness, end quote. I like that.
It's nice to have a president remark on your death. I mean, I think he would think that was pretty cool, you know, no matter when you go, you know, you want to know that you left something good behind. And he said that he thought he left maybe two movies behind that, you know, people would remember. And I think he sold himself short there, didn't realize maybe how great it was. He's going to have a private funeral, but there will be a public memorial in Chicago for him, likely in May, they say. So Harold Ramis is dead, but long live Harold Ramis.
Absolutely. And I think I'm going to go and figure out some great stuff of his to watch tonight and have a great laugh once again, thanks to him.
The laughs live on forever. Thanks for joining us, folks.
I'm Owen Mugen.
I'm Dean Karyanis.
We'll see you soon.
Popping her fingers and shuffling her feet, singing do a diddy dum diddy dum. She looked good, she looked fine, looked fine, looked good, she looked fine, and I nearly lost my mind. Before I knew it, she was walking next to me, singing.
Visit angryhistory.com to learn more about the topics discussed on today's episode. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You can also like us on Facebook, tweet us at Angry History, or send us an email to angry@angryhistory.com.